Those options that are all on the table with North Korea, do you suppose there are any economic ones? From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Washington today, I'm Kai Rizdal, the 17th of April, Monday. Good as always to have you along, everybody. Take some nuclear weapons, throw in some deep geopolitical uncertainty, tried but largely failed economic sanctions, intense global attention, and a new approach from the United States. And therein lies the current North Korean dilemma. The BBC is reporting that North Korea is going to start testing missiles weekly. South Korea, meanwhile, has doubled down on a missile defense system that China says is a threat to it. Vice President Pence in South Korea at the DMZ over the weekend said all options are on the table. So Marketplace's Sabri Benishore gets us going with this. A look at what those options might be short of, you know, actual shooting.
America's goal is to end North Korea's nuclear program. In the 90s, the U.S. tried carrots.
The U.S. promised to build light water reactors that were supposed to be proliferation resistant in North Korea and provide them with heavy fuel oil in return for their dismantlement of their nuclear program.
That didn't work. This is Scott Snyder with the Council on Foreign Relations, by the way. Early in the Bush administration, the U.S. discovered North Korea was cheating. For a while, the U.S. tried offering food aid to get North Korea to the bargaining table.
We paid for him to show up at the meetings, but essentially the North Koreans pocketed payments but never moved forward.
So nobody in Washington really trusts that carrots will work. The U.S. has tried a number of sticks through the U.N., capping of coal exports, for example. That's gotten us, well, where we are now, with North Korea launching missile tests. Troy Stangerone is with the Korea Economic Institute and says some sanctions could be tightened.
We're considering a range of options at the United Nations, working with China to take and cut off oil shipments to North Korea, going after either textile exports, fish exports, mineral exports.
But the reach of the U.S., even through the U.N., extends only so far.
China's cooperation is key to this.
The Trump administration is now trying to convince China to crack down on trade over the border with North Korea and Chinese businesses involved with the regime. But China doesn't want to push so hard that it ends up with the chaos of a collapsed North Korea on its doorstep. Douglas Paul is with the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace.
You know, if you're looking for a solution, you may not find one. That's the problem.
Which makes this situation all the more unpredictable. In New York, I'm Sabri Benishore for Marketplace.
Three words to set up this next story, each of them fine by themselves, not so good in combination. Here you go. BP, oil, and leaking. There's a BP well that's leaking way up in the Alaskan Arctic. Not a whole lot of details yet, except for the certainty that this is going to prompt a new round of questions about whether to drill in the northernmost stretches of this planet, even as the Trump administration appears set to go all in on Arctic oil. From the Sustainability Desk, Marketplace's Scott Tong has that one.
Crude oil began spilling out of the BP well on Friday. Alaska authorities say that's been stopped, though natural gas is still venting out. No reports of injuries or impacts to wildlife. No estimate of how much oil has leaked. And for now, the cause is unknown. Still, business professor Holly Bell at the University of Alaska thinks this is minor.
The consensus right now is that this is a relatively small leak. So I don't think this is going to cause a long-term issue or that it's going to cause a lot of environmental damage.
It will cause environmental debate. We are talking about the Alaskan Arctic. Onshore, the oil wells are near polar bears, caribou herds, and other species. Offshore drilling, well, that was banned by President Obama, though his successor wants to reverse that. And we're talking about BP. This week is the 7th anniversary of the blowout in the Gulf, where there's warmer water and no ice, says Dan Ritzman at the Sierra Club.
Now we're looking at the BP oil well up in Alaska in a much harsher environment. And if you take that onshore environment and you move it to the offshore, it's even worse.
President Trump, though, will likely push ahead on Arctic drilling. But does the world need the oil? There's ample supply right now in the lower 48, says Stephen Kopitz at Princeton Energy Advisors.
We have easy oil available now in Texas and other places as well. So the need to go to a more complex and expensive place like Alaska right now, it's just not there.
A complex place. Today's weather, gusting winds, and potential whiteout conditions. I'm Scott Tong for Marketplace.
Here's a phrase you've probably heard, fair trade. You know it most likely from coffee or chocolate, perhaps. Soon the first American seafood is going to get that label, as Marketplace's Jed Kim reports.
If you're a socially conscious seafood eater, you've got options. There's the Marine Stewardship Council's Sustainable Seafood Mark. The Monterey Bay Aquarium has a Seafood Watch app to help you shop. Ashley Oppel manages the seafood program at Fairtrade USA. She says her organization's certification is different because it considers workers' conditions and social benefits.
Other seafood certifications, at least for wild capture, really only focus on environmental sustainability of the stock.
For U.S. scallop fishers, the premium price that comes with the label could help ease some regulatory costs.
Fishermen are still dealing with having to provide a lot of data and a lot of tracking on their vessels, and that can be very expensive. And so part of the premium can be used to ensure the health of the stock.
Can the market sustain yet another label for responsible seafood?
If we ever got to the point where sustainability labels were competing with each other, that'd probably be a good problem to have.
Tim Fitzgerald focuses on fisheries for the Environmental Defense Fund. He's also on the advisory committee for Fairtrade's seafood program. He says one big benefit of the label, people recognize it.
With Fairtrade getting into seafood, I think it puts social responsibility and environmental responsibility on the radar of just a huge amount more people.
Still, he says price is the main factor when people choose which fish they'll buy. And the Fairtrade scallops that'll roll out later this month will cost a little more. I'm Jed Kim for Marketplace.
Wall Street Today looks like that three-day holiday the traders got did them a whole world of good. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. It's been just about a year, year and a half, since a broken gas well sent tens of thousands of tons of natural gas into the air in a neighborhood called Porter Ranch, way out on the far northern edges of Los Angeles. The leak was eventually capped, but Porter Ranch is the worst methane leak ever in this country, and some residents say they are still feeling the effects. Even with all that, though, the housing market there is booming, especially up on the high end. From KPCC, Ben Bergman reports.
Longtime Porter Ranch real estate agent Ken Sampson says these days he rarely gets questions from potential buyers about the gas field, which is one of the biggest in the country.
Maybe one out of every 15 asked today. A year ago was on everybody's mind.
He says for many people, the whole thing that caused 8,000 residents to be evacuated for months is already a distant memory.
It was a shock to all of us the facility was even there. But I believe that as a whole, the public in general doesn't really pay attention to it, to be honest with you.
Except for people like Lori Kerrigan, who says her family's health is still affected long after the leak was capped.
People that actually have experienced the grief and the doctor's appointments and the constant nosebleeds and rashes, they're not willing to go buy another house in Porter Ranch. They're willing to get as far away as possible.
A couple weeks ago, Kerrigan moved her three dogs and six kids to a house farther from the gas field. And Kerrigan is also a realtor, so recently she found herself in the strange position of steering a client away from buying in a massive new planned community here being built by the home building company Toll Brothers.
I told him, you know, don't buy until you know for sure. You have two small kids. Don't do it.
Was it tough to convince them?
Yes.
Kerrigan says it's tough to convince clients to stay away because they are getting the impression from Toll Brothers that everything is fixed.
If it's fixed, you assume it's okay. Not that it's an ongoing fight right now, not that we don't know what caused the blowout, and there are issues with the construction and how old it is.
The development sits just about a mile from where the gas leak was, so demand has even surprised Toll Brothers executives who plan to build more than 1,400 homes in these hills overlooking the San Fernando Valley in the coming years. The company told investors it didn't have to offer discounts after the leak. Houses range from just under $1 million to well over $2 million, record sales prices never seen before this year in Porter Ranch. So what does Toll Brothers tell prospective buyers who fear they might be in danger? Here's the company's vice president, Frank Sue.
We tell them that the leak has been capped. The facility's been there for 50-plus years. It's probably the most regulated facility in the entire country. We feel like it's going to be very safe in the future. And most of our buyers that are coming in today, that's enough for them.
And if it's not, Sue refers people to government agencies and to the company that owns the gas field, which maintains it's perfectly safe to operate. And Sue says he wouldn't be recommending Porter Ranch if he didn't live here happily with his family.
We were here during the leak. You know, my kids weren't affected. Porter Ranch is still a great place to live. It's not a horrible place.
It's also one of the rare places in L.A. with top schools, low crime rates, and the ability to customize a home from the ground up with a view. For buyers like Gabriel and Erica Barajas, those positives far outweigh any possible risks. They recently closed on a large house here.
I grew up in the San Fernando Valley, and me growing up always wanted to have a house up in the hills, and I finally bought it. I told my wife that I was going to buy this house even if I have to wear a gas mask.
And his wife, Erica Barajas, says she has no worries either.
I know that they wouldn't be building these homes if we were in danger.
Regulators still don't know exactly what caused the leak. Recently, a California Senate committee approved an emergency bill that would keep the gas field closed until the state finishes a study to determine what happened. In Porter Ranch, California, I'm Ben Bergman for Marketplace.
This is going to sound like an, of course, Kai, that's their job thing to say, but Google is trying to make the world a little bit more Googleable, if that makes any sense. It's how they're doing it that's interesting. Earlier this month, Adobe and Google partnered to release something called Noto Serif CJK. That's a typeface that's consistent between a bunch of different alphabets, but most particularly Chinese, Japanese, and Korean. No easy thing to do. Margaret Rhodes is a staff writer for Wired. She covers design. Margaret, good to have you with us.
Thanks for having me.
Google and Adobe worked together for years on this project. Why is a consistent, what do you call it, font, typeface, typeset, why is it important to them?
This is important to them because, Google has an international audience. So does Adobe. And when you have an international audience, you have people who need to create products across different languages. Before this existed, the kind of only option that you would have is if you want to make your magazine available for readers in another country, you have to choose a totally different typeface. And when you do that, you forfeit this look you've created. You wanted it to have a feel. You choose another typeface, it might lose that feel. Or if you have a need to use different languages in one screen or on one product, they kind of get jumbled. And Bob Young at Google, he handles their internationalization efforts. He refers to that as the ransom note effect. So, you know, that kind of like schizophrenic,
jumbled look. Boy, that's a good image. Yeah.
So you don't have that when you have access to fonts like these. You have this fidelity across products. And then what is really cool is that as a designer or developer, when you really care about your product, you get to show users in different countries that you are thinking of them, that you didn't just sort of, convert something made for a Chinese audience to Korean. You know, it's personal.
Right. It's respect for the audience. Well, and that actually gets to sort of an interesting part of this. We all know that Google's trying to take over the world, right? I mean, I say that tongue in cheek, but I mean, that's kind of the mission, right? The mission is they want to categorize all the world's information and blah, blah, blah. It's interesting that this American company is now designing these fonts and typefaces for an Asian audience.
Yes, yeah. Absolutely. There's a lot of people who want to access these products.
Right.
And
I
think there's also a lot of people who use these different languages. And so being able to sort of, bring them together visually is it's a pretty cool thing to be able to do.
Is it hard to do this design work? I mean, it took years, right? And probably a lot of smart people sitting in a room.
Yeah. The reason that Google went to Adobe for the CJK, Chinese, Japanese, Korean scripts, it kind of all has to do with this one guy, a linguist and a computer scientist who's been at Adobe for a while. His name's Ken Lundy. And he has been studying these letter forms for years. He told me that he got interested in the topic when he was studying Japanese. This is 1985. But over the course of all these years, he has written books on the topic of how you handle these East Asian languages on a computer. If you were to pull up a Word document and you were to type your name in three different fonts, and let's say you've got a lowercase e in there, the curve in that e could look different in each version of your name.
Right.
And that's because the designer specifically chose to make that curve look differently.
Huh.
And they do that across the entire font they design. So in Latin languages, there are 26 letters, and then there's a smattering of, you know, characters, numbers.
Right.
But in Chinese, Japanese, Korean scripts, there are tens of thousands of characters. Hmm. So that minuscule work that goes into making, you know, one E look like that E, you have to multiply that work times thousands.
Man, it's cool stuff. Margaret Rhodes is a staff writer at Wired, where she covers design. Margaret, thanks very much.
Thanks for having me.
Coming up.
Every job I've had has come from some kind of inspiration.
Count the former CEO of Chanel as one of the lucky ones. First, though, let's do the numbers. Dow Industrial's up 183 points today, 9/10%, 20,636. The NASDAQ up 51 points, about 8/10%, 58.56. The S&P 500 also up 20 points, 8/10% there, 23.49. First day back after the long Easter weekend, as I mentioned. We told you about Google's typography achievements. Well, today the company agreed to an antitrust fine of 438 million rubles. That's about $8 million American to you and me. Levied by Russia, rubles, Russia, for preloading mobile phones there with Google apps. Kind of bothered the Russian search engine Yandex. Alphabet, the parent company shares still clicked up 1.7% today. Other tech stocks up as well. Amazon up almost 2%. Microsoft, 0.8%. To the good. We mentioned BP's oil well leak in the Arctic. Share slipped more than 0.25% today. Chevron pretty much flat. Bonds fell. The yield on the 10-year T-note up to 2.24%. You're listening to Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl.
And I'm Molly Wood.
On our podcast, Make Me Smart, we ask our guests this.
What is something you thought you knew, but you later found out you were wrong about?
If you play by the rules, you win.
Hard lessons from Elevest CEO Sally Krawchuk. Stunning realizations, though, from TV legend Norman Lear.
I wouldn't have said that I was capable of murder.
Trust me, you got to hear that story.
Yeah. And of course, a really important lesson about livestock from the CEO of Reddit.
I thought that a pony was a baby horse.
Turns out it's not. It's just a small horse. Come join the conversation at marketplace.org/makemesmart.
This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. I was in Boston a couple of weeks ago making my way around in the rental car almost entirely with navigation apps. And I can't tell you the number of times I was in one of the tunnels in that city and my GPS just gave up the ghost, completely blanked out on me, which meant, of course, that once I got out of the tunnel, it took me and my phone a while to figure out which way I needed to go. Well, in some tunnels in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania right now, there is an app to take care of that, as Erica Barris reports.
Rita Green has been driving Pittsburgh roads for decades and still struggles when she's coming out of one of the city's two main tunnels.
It's very confusing, and you can just see the jockeying of the different cars and people cutting each other off. It's insane.
That's because at the end of the tunnels, there are about a dozen options for which way to go and just a few seconds to pick one. Even if you're using a GPS, it doesn't matter. Just about every system dies in a tunnel, which compounds that chaos. Well, one driving app won't die in the tunnels here. In the fall, Waze, a Google-owned company, installed beacons, small, battery-powered devices. Through Bluetooth, their GPS keeps working in two of Pittsburgh's tunnels. The beacons are the brainchild of Gil Desotnick, an engineer at Waze, a crowdsourced driving app. He lost signal driving in a tunnel and set out to solve what he calls tunnel blindness.
The app will try to estimate where you are, which is a bit of a problem if you're slowing down or speeding up. It's going to lose accuracy very fast.
It took a couple years, but he came up with beacons. They're small, the size of three AAA batteries. They cost under $30 a piece. Transportation officials attach them on tunnel light fixtures.
And they transmit radio signal 10 times every second. And they allow us to receive that signal and pinpoint our own location inside the tunnel.
They're also in tunnels in Israel, Brazil, and France. Even before reliance on GPS, tunnel driving has been difficult for drivers.
As you go from light to dark, you have a momentary adjustment of the lighting in your eye, the responses of the photoreceptors in your eye.
That's Roberta Klatsky. She teaches psychology and human-computer interaction at Carnegie Mellon University.
It's like when you go into a dark theater or something like that. At first you don't see anything, and then gradually you can see all the people around you in the seats.
Klatsky says our minds are trying to compute speed and choices. The more there are, the harder it is to choose one. And it's more confusing when a reliance on a faulty GPS enters the picture.
And that may be one reason people want to slow at the end of a tunnel, is they want to give themselves more processing time in this race between the car, the technology, and their own brains.
To find out how well the beacons work, I went into the Fort Pitt Tunnel with Ben DeVore. He's an engineer with Pennsylvania's Department of Transportation.
In 1.2 miles, exit to exit 78, Boulevard.
Using Waze, he drives me through the tunnel, and the app stays on.
In half a mile, exit right, then stay to the left.
That's the type of information you wouldn't have gotten before.
DeVore helped install the beacons. That tiny stretch where drivers exit the tunnel sees between 100 to 300 accidents a month.
There tends to be more incidents than normal than an average stretch of interstate.
DeVore thinks the Waze beacons will cut down on accidents. Next fall, when they've been in place for a year, he'll know more. In Pittsburgh, I'm Erica Barris for Marketplace.
Interesting item in the Wall Street Journal over the weekend. Last year, for the first time since 2009, which was, as you remember, the deepest depths of the recession, sales of personal luxury goods, clothing mostly and accessories, went down. Maureen Chiquet has had a front row seat to the changes at the very top end of the retail food chain. After working for iconic brands like L'Oreal and Gap, she spent 9 years running the French luxury retailer Chanel. And her memoir about her career is called Beyond the Label. Thanks for coming on.
Thank you. It's great to be here, Kai.
You start this book with a shopping spree, because basically you left Chanel and you chucked your whole wardrobe, or you put it in storage or something, right?
I definitely put it in storage.
Yeah. Quite symbolic. I mean, there was clearly a lot going on in your mind.
Yeah, you know, it's funny. I had worn a uniform for, 13 years since I'd been at Chanel, and it was composed of things from my wardrobe before, but almost every outfit literally had a Chanel jacket. And so in a way, it started to identify me. So the symbolism of actually going through and purging and cleaning my closet was really about reclaiming who I was originally and reclaiming myself in so many ways.
Well, it's interesting because you say in this book that you are not frilly and you are not fussy, and yet you have a very finely tuned sense of style, clearly working for Chanel. The question has to be asked is, how does a woman from St. Louis wind up running the world's most recognized luxury brands?
I think taking a very unorthodox route. You know, for me, it all started with goat cheese. I know that sounds really strange.
I enjoyed that passage. No, go ahead.
But it's true. I mean, my senses got blown wide open by being in France the first time and really soaking up all the beauty and loving the way that the French could take in beauty and appreciate it. So it started there. And of course, from there, I ended up going back several times through college. After college, I had no sense of or any idea of what I could do and wanting desperately to go to France. And that was my first job at L'Oreal. So anyway, long story short, from the Gap, back to the Gap and into Chanel later on.
Talk to me about the consumer in retail today, because American consumers, globally really probably, consumers are notoriously fickle. The stakes that you all on the retail end play on are extremely high. How do you use gut and data?
Yeah, first of all, I think the consumer has changed, and there have been major, massive disruptions in the business. Obviously, the internet and what that's done to the way that we shop and what we expect from brands. And then, of course, these millennials or Generation Y and Z, however you want to call them, who have so many different values and are making decisions with a different frame. So I think that does require us to look different, look at data, but also to tap into what this generation cares about and what's going on in the world and how they're shopping.
Once you finish the book tour and all of that and whatever, I guess, side consulting gigs you've got going, any desire to get back into retail at whatever level?
You know, it's so funny. I have every job I've had has come from some kind of inspiration. You know, I left for France to work at L'Oreal mostly because I loved Paris. I loved France. I fell into the Gap, quote unquote, because I saw that poster of Miles Davis and he was wearing a Gap t-shirt. And I ended up going to Chanel because I read about her and her story, and I led there. So my answer to you is, if the inspiration is there, yes, but who knows?
Maureen Chiquet used to be the global CEO at Chanel. Her new book is called Beyond the Label. Maureen, thanks a lot.
Thanks so much, Kai. Nice talking to you.
This final note on the way out today. You know how British Prime Minister Theresa May likes to say that Brexit means Brexit, no take-backs or halfway measures when it comes to pulling out of the European Union? Yeah, well, maybe the PM needs to wake up and smell the coffee. Home Secretary Amber Rudd has a proposal on the table for what are being called barista visas. Plan is to let workers with EU passports keep coming to the UK to make sure coffee shops and pubs are fully staffed. I kid you not. Non-fat latte for me, please. All right, we got to go. The Dow up 183 points on this Monday, 9/10%, 20,636. The NASDAQ up 51 points, about 8/10%, 58.56 there. The S&P 500 rose 20 points, about 8/10%, finished at 23.49. Our daily production team includes Bridget Bodner, Robert Garoba, Jenny Josephson, and Daisy Palacios. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.